From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine, Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas, and our moderator is Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome, everyone. These are the issues we're going to be discussing today. President Trump and Democratic nominee Joe Biden trade schoolyard insults in a chaotic first presidential debate. A grim new milestone. The coronavirus death toll passes 1 million worldwide. Congressional compromise. Signs the Democrats in the White House may be closer to a deal on another stimulus package as U.S. companies continue to lay off workers. Also, violence in the Caucasus, a fight between two former Soviet republics threatened to spiral into a regional war. Molly, Abdulrahim, glad to have you guys both on the show today. Let's get right into the biggest story of the week, which was the first presidential debate between President Trump and the Democratic nominee Joe Biden. There have been a lot of adjectives thrown around to describe this debate. A disaster, a train wreck, the worst debate ever. But Molly, what was your overall impression of what we saw Tuesday?
Yeah, I would add variations on those exact same adjectives, right? It was just a mess. It was just not structured in any way, not able to be, you know, organized and have a coherent discussion. And the reason for that was really that President Trump decided he was not going to respect the rules in any way. And although both campaigns had agreed to a structure for the debate where there would be, you know, certain segments around certain topics and each candidate would have a certain fixed amount of time to speak and then to respond to each other, instead, the president just continually interrupted both his opponent and the moderator, talking over them, insulting them in many cases, and refusing to give Joe Biden, his opponent, a word in edgewise, to the point that it just devolved into chaos, everybody yelling at each other, everybody insulting each other in some ways. So if what viewers were looking for was, you know, some sort of enlightening policy discussion where they would really get to see where the candidates stand on the issues, that really didn't happen. But if the viewers were just hoping to get a sense of who these two guys are and what their sort of temperaments and dispositions are, you did pretty much see that on pretty blatant display.
Right. So more like political theater than a forum for substance and high-minded debate Tuesday. Abdulrahim, the thing is that President Trump's supporters, they like when he's a bully, when he doesn't follow those accepted, agreed on rules of decorum. But what about those Republicans who in 2016, they held their nose, they voted for him anyway? How do you think they're feeling after this debate?
Well, we know that some of them have expressed discomfort about what happened during the debate on the part of President Trump in particular. We know also that some of them are feeling discomfort in silence because they're facing themselves a tough election and they're worried about their potential losses in these elections.
You're talking about Republican lawmakers who are feeling...
Yes, right. Republican lawmakers, yes. But the fact remains that the president has been saying things that have made a lot of Americans feel on edge. And he's been saying that for a long time. In fact, I personally think he's made a career of that. He's very skillful at straddling certain lines that make his opponents feel very uncomfortable. Therefore, many other Republicans feel that they can continue to support him because he's doing that. You know, you could look at what happened in the debate in so many different ways. One of them, you could just say two grumpy old men on a stage basically slinging it out in a country which is bursting with young talent, bursting with energy. It just sounded and looked really weird. Another way of looking at it has something to do, in my view, with the political culture of the United States. I mean, for those people who say, I have to wait until the debate to make up my mind, you know, that may sound really odd because the president, President Trump, has been the president of the United States for over 3 years. So it's very strange that people would wait for a particular debate to help them decide. But we all know that the value of these debates, televised debates in the United States, is that Americans are very visual, and Americans have been throughout their history shown the greatest talent for being the masters of entertainment. And television impacts Americans and American life in very profound ways. So whether the debate was orderly or chaotic, it has had an impact. And we all are seeing, you know, the post-debate time. There is serious acrimonious debate going on now in the United States, going back over some of the things that Biden said, some of the things that Trump said on race and ethnicity.
Exactly. I want to pick up on that last point when we're talking about race, Abdurrahim just brought up. Molly, the president is getting a lot of criticism for not going ahead and condemning white supremacists when he was really just given the chance by Chris Wallace, the moderator. The president refused to do so. How are Republican lawmakers responding to what the president did or didn't say?
They're really distancing themselves from it. This was really the biggest headline, I think, from the whole proceedings. And it's part of a pattern that goes back to 2016, where Trump at that time was repeatedly asked to denounce David Duke, who had endorsed him, other white supremacists and members of the so-called alt-right who had started to coalesce around his campaign at that time. And he repeatedly declined to do so. He has this prerogative that anyone who supports him can be bad in his view. And so he has never wanted to condemn someone he sees as supporting him, no matter how odious their views might be or how racist, how violent their orientation, which is the case with this particular organization, the Proud Boys, a sort of quasi-militia with neo-fascist ties that was brought up actually by Joe Biden, and that Trump then told to, instead of saying, I want nothing to do with them, I don't want their support, what he said was to stand down and stand by, which sounded to some people almost like he was portraying himself as the commander of this militia and telling them to, you know, await his instructions. So it was very disturbing for a lot of people, especially, you know, in the wake of this summer's massive racial justice protests all across the United States and all around the world. There's been a heightened sensitivity to issues of race. And I think for a lot of Americans, particularly those swing voters we've been talking about, those suburban voters, women voters, the kinds of voters who might still be trying to make up their minds or might have soured on Trump's and supporting him 4 years ago. Those kinds of voters, we know from polls and focus groups, are particularly disturbed by Trump's divisiveness, by his refusal to try to, you know, bring people together and sound notes of racial concern and reconciliation. So this was not the kind of remark that sets those concerns at ease. Rather, it really sort of tends to pour gasoline on those types of divisions. So to your question, a lot of Republican lawmakers have tried to either to spin Trump's remarks as something other than what they were, or to distance themselves from them, or to say he misspoke.
Even Mitch McConnell, the most important, most powerful senator, Republican senator, distancing themselves from President Trump. But we've really been focusing on President Trump's performance, but I want to look at Joe Biden's performance. Abdurrahim, the response to Biden's performance seems to be he was fine. He didn't have the sharpest answers. He wouldn't answer a question about packing the Supreme Court. Other answers, like on the economy or on a climate plan, were confusing or sometimes misleading. He also used petty insults like calling Trump a clown or telling him to shut up. But he also stood his ground. Even with all those interruptions, he didn't come off as senile or mentally slow as the president's campaign says he is. So overall, looking at Joe Biden's performance, was it enough to help him a couple weeks before the election?
For those people who were waiting for the debate to make up their mind about Joe Biden. And as we know, there are a lot of people sitting on the fence with regard to Joe Biden. A lot of people are considering voting for him just because they've decided they cannot vote for Trump. For those people and like-minded voters, Joe Biden did not really have the opportunity to explain in ample clarity his position on issues in ways that would completely sway them, convince them to vote for him. However, you know, another layer to that, it seems to me, is that because President Trump behaved the way he did and didn't give much of an opportunity to Joe Biden, supposedly, to explain his positions clearly to voters, a lot of people will take that as a sign that Joe Biden can handle difficult situations. So by default, President Trump ended up actually helping, it seems to me, Joe Biden convince some people. I'm not sure what the percentage would be in terms of the people who would either change their mind or suddenly see the light in Joe Biden. But remember that Joe Biden, as you pointed out, he was also complicit, if I may use the term, in the chaos that happened during the debate. I mean, he hollered to President Trump, "Shut up, man." He interrupted the president when he said, "Inshallah," which could mean that's never going to happen, when Trump was talking about when he's going to publish his taxes and so on. So, you know, he also has his own share of responsibility in the chaos that happened. It'd be interesting to see in the next debate, which I understand will be in the form of a town hall. It'll be interesting to see if all goes well and Biden has the space that he wants to have to explain his positions. It'll be interesting to see how that goes with people who are still dithering whether to vote for him or not.
You are much more of an optimist than most if you think that it all might go well in the next debate. But let's take a break here because we've got to pause, but we're going to continue the conversation when we get back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Molly Baugh, National Political Correspondent for Time Magazine. Abdulrahim Fakhari, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, Political and Foreign Affairs Correspondent.
Welcome back. We've been talking about Tuesday's first presidential debate, which was a chaotic affair, to say the least. Abdurrahim brought up a point that there might be many voters who were still undecided before watching the debate. Would you agree with that, or do you think most people sort of made up their minds already and what they saw just confirmed what they think?
Well, on the one hand, we have seen in polls and other data that the number of undecided voters in this election is unusually low, that in fact, many Americans have made up their mind perhaps, you know, years ago, even before Joe Biden got into the race and before he wrapped up the Democratic nomination and before the COVID-19 pandemic that has upended so many aspects of American life. Even before all of those things, Joe Biden led Donald Trump in head-to-head polls by almost about the same amount that he does now. It's been an extremely stable race, and that appears to be because Trump is such a singular figure who has so polarized the nation for and against him that everyone knows who he is and most people know where they stand on him. Now, political scientists will tell you that the American swing voter was an endangered species long before that. Most people are pretty cemented in their sort of political tribe in America. There are always a few people on the fence. And the candidates, of course, are trying to reach people who may not think they are on the fence, but who might still be open to an argument that catches their attention. Right. I think especially for Trump being the underdog in the race at this point, he needed to try to reach out to people who might have turned their backs on him and try to get them back, try to convince them to give him another chance. So there's always the opportunity to move the needle with a high profile event like this. And the debate did get quite high ratings. A lot of people were watching. But we do think that the number of people who are undecided, who are caught in the middle, is even lower than it normally is.
Before we move on from this topic, Abdurrahim, I wanted you to give us the global perspective. How are other countries reacting to what they saw?
There's always been a lot of interest in U.S. elections in other parts of the world. There's even more interest this time. I mean, the viewership in the United States was high. About 70 million people are supposed to have watched the debate here in the U.S. compared with, you know, 80 million, I understand, in the past. The viewership in the Middle East, for example, was extremely high. A lot of people watched the debate. As you know, the president, in the same way that he does here in the United States, he does elsewhere, particularly in a place like the Middle East. East, there are a lot of governments that are very anxious to see what happens in the next election. A lot of governments in the Middle East are worried that he may lose the election to Joe Biden, talking about Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Egypt, and the list goes on. But on a popular level, I would say that the audience is divided in the following way. There are those who don't like the policies of Donald Trump. They do not necessarily support the policies of Joe Biden because a lot of them feel the policies will not be very different when it comes to foreign policy. And there are those parts of the viewership that are jaded about U.S. politics at the end of the day. To them, they'll shrug it off and they'll say, you know, whether it's Trump or Biden, it's not going to bring much change. And as I said, governments in those countries that I mentioned would obviously strongly disagree with that. But there's definitely a lot of interest in the debate. And in other parts of the world, they tend to have a lot of knowledge of the U.S. political system. They know that there are other debates happening. They know the formats. And I bet you a lot of people are gearing up to watch what happens in the next debate, in the next town hall.
Yeah, and Molly, I know you're going to be watching as well and discussing that in your reporting. But I want to move on to what else is going on in the world. We hit a new grim milestone this week in the fight against the coronavirus. More than 1 million people have now died from COVID-19. It's a staggering number. Each one, obviously, its own tragedy. But Molly, what does it tell us, this number, 1 million deaths? What does it tell us about where the world stands right now on containing the virus?
I think it's quite simple. We have failed to contain it. Obviously, the situation is different in different countries, extremely different in a lot of cases. But it's not any one country's problem. This is a global pandemic, and it has been for many months. And many countries, especially in Europe, are starting to see new surges, new upticks in cases, in hospitalizations, in deaths. Many things have changed since the beginning of the pandemic, particularly doctors know much better how to treat COVID-19, but we don't have a cure, we don't have a vaccine, and even countries that have done a very good job of containing it are not totally free of the virus. And, you know, particularly in the United States, where a lot has been said and written about various mistakes and missed opportunities, it continues to have a very high rate of infection and hundreds of deaths every single day. And these grim milestones keep on coming. And I think it's very discouraging to people who have been living with this for so long, living in fear of going outside and being around people, having their livelihoods demolished in many cases, having the aid that initially came from the federal government has now run out. And so a lot of people are facing quite dire circumstances, whether individuals or businesses.
I think you mentioned the cold weather is coming, where public health experts are really afraid that if people start moving indoors, that there's going to be another spike. You also have schools starting to reopen. New York City, the largest school district in the country, has started reopening in-person classes. Los Angeles, another big city, they're going to resume possibly in-person classes soon. The White House says it's going to be shipping millions of rapid tests to schools to encourage other school districts to open. Abdurrahim, do you think that'll encourage more schools to reopen, getting those tests, and make parents more comfortable about sending their children to school?
It's possible, but, you know, there are other factors at play here, other factors why parents feel, at least in many parts of the United States, in many parts of the world, they feel that it's time to get the kids back to school, because kids staying at home has not been a very healthy thing to do, because they do not have the means to actually continue to stay at home to provide for their families while the kids continue their distance learning. So many different factors that are pushing parents to even hold the bull by the horns and say, I know that there is a lot of risk in sending my kids to school, but I am at least keen to start seriously thinking about a time when I should send them if I'm not doing it already. But we as human beings, we've always tended to connect what's happening in society with the elements. There was a time, you'll recall, here in the United States, but also in Europe, in Africa, other parts of the world, where people were saying, well, it looks like the summer is going to be a good time to get this thing under control because of the heat. And now we're saying, well, we're really worried about the cold winter because there's going to be all sorts of types of flu, and we may not be able to distinguish between a normal flu and the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, and we saw the numbers actually spiking in the summer, even though President Trump was suggesting that the virus would disappear. But Molly, I want to talk about the economic impact of the virus. Disney is now announcing that they're going to be laying off nearly 30,000 employees. Other companies are continuing to cut jobs as well. There have been months of stalled negotiations in Congress over another relief bill. But there seems to be some encouraging signs that there's compromise coming. What are you hearing?
Just to go back to the schools issue for a minute, I would say that the main thing driving schools reopening is that there doesn't seem to be too much risk, that we have not seen in the school districts that have opened them be the sources of outbreaks, that in fact the schools have had far, far lower rates of infection than other aspects of the community. So that, I think, more than any dictate from the administration, which has lost a lot of credibility on this issue, is driving people's decision making, it seems. But yes, the economic impact is becoming more dire as that federal aid has run out, as you mentioned, the travel industry, mass layoffs also in the airlines and many other businesses. The Democrats in Congress who control the House of Representatives have assumed that the president and Republican Party will see that it is not only, in their view, the right thing to do to help all these Americans who are suffering through no fault of their own with some kind of aid, but they will be politically motivated to do so, that the president will see that it's in his interest, in the interest of his reelection, to not let these people go without help. Even if it does go against some Republican values by, you know, spending a lot of tax money and adding to the deficit. So the Democrats who passed their own bill many months ago with trillions of dollars in aid have been shocked and puzzled at Republicans' refusal to come to the table and negotiate really at all. The Republicans have sort of walked away from the table months ago and declined to do anything. And now they've come back to the table. But they've finally come calling the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, who's been House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's main negotiating partner on these relief bills, has come calling once again, and they are talking. There's some wariness among Republicans because there is a feeling that Pelosi got the better of Mnuchin in previous rounds of these talks and that so much money was spent, it might be time to shut the door. But I think the political realities, the fact that the previous rounds of aid were extremely popular and clearly helped a lot of people. You can see in all of the economic data that even though a lot of people are unemployed, the reason that the stock market has remained high and the reason that people have not in large part, you know, been destitute and been broke, been going bankrupt has been because of these outlays by the federal government. So as more and more businesses express angst and see consequences like these mass layoffs, it seems to finally be waking up some of these politicians that they might need to do more. Whether that means they can come to a deal is anybody's guess. These are tough issues and Capitol Hill is not a place where a lot gets done on a normal day due to, you know, partisanship and everything else. So who knows if they'll actually get there, but it certainly is an encouraging sign that these negotiations have started once again.
Yeah, and as you said, both parties are not even unified on exactly what they want here. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I really want, Avdarim, for you to weigh in on what is happening in the caucuses right now. Deadly fighting has broken out between Armenia and Azerbaijan over a disputed region. Over 100 people have already been killed, including civilians. There are fears this could escalate. Why are world leaders so worried about this flare-up, and why should our listeners be paying attention?
Well, so many different reasons, but very quickly, this is a conflict that has been dormant for a long time since the early 1990s. All sorts of powers are now involved in it. There's obviously the two countries directly concerned, Azerbaijan and Armenia. And there are those who support one country or the other. The Turks are on the side of Azerbaijan. The Iranians, for example, the French, even the Russians are on the side of Armenia. The area has a lot of oil. A lot of oil comes from that part of the world through Turkey to Europe. That's making the Russians nervous because the Russians want their own oil to be reaching Europe. So this is a confluence of history, geography, and huge economic interests. Just to quickly add that for Turkey, the Turks feel that its problems going on in the Eastern Mediterranean with Greece, it feels that its adversaries are trying to encircle it by, you know, stoking another conflict now between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan being the gateway for Turkey to that part of the world.
Yeah, and President Trump has weighed in saying that the U.S. is friends with both countries and we'll see if we can stop it. President Trump said it'll be interesting to see if the U.S. does more here and gets more involved. That is all the time we have. Thanks to Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.